Hello, welcome to the MJA podcast. My name's Kate Swanell. This week I had the pleasure of chatting with Emeritus Professor Paul Worley, the National Rural Health Commissioner. Paul and a couple of his colleagues have written an article for the MJA on the National Rural Generalist Pathway, an education framework which many believe will revitalise generalism in the bush. You've been in the Rural Health Commissioner's job for, what, about 18 months now, I think, isn't it? How's it been? What's been happening? Are you happy with where things have moved to?
It's been a wonderful privilege, Kate. The opportunity to work with Commonwealth ministers who are really enthusiastic about making a difference, getting something done.
Great.
Doesn't come along very often. To have that opportunity to do that on a national scale in an area where most of the research has been done already. It's really a research translation exercise.
Yes.
That's the key. And that's, you know, something that academically has been of great interest to me for a long time as well. So it's really a benefit on two levels. Academically, wonderful to be able to see the research over the last couple of decades getting into policy, and then at the same time seeing a lot of my rural colleagues really excited that people are taking their issues seriously.
There's been an awful lot of scepticism about politicians lately, of course, but you seem quite optimistic about how they are willing to be guided. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. Yeah. Very, very optimistic that they recognise the problem, recognise the scale of the solutions that are necessary, and prepared to do the work with their jurisdictional colleagues to make it happen.
Is it fair to say that the National Rural Generalist Pathway is an attempt to turn the current system on its head a little bit, instead of training people in the city and hoping they either go home to the country to practice or decide to go and work in the bush? What you're proposing is to train people in the bush who want to be in the bush, and that will help solve the iniquities that we've got. Is that a fair description of what the pathway is trying to do?
One way that has been described is in your terms, flipping the model.
Yeah.
Where you're enabling people to live and be based rurally and then do some urban inreach.
Yes.
In their education when necessary. The other way of describing it is what we're doing is learning from what's worked in cities,
right,
and applying that in the bush. And what's worked in the cities is major academic tertiary centres have grown their own workforce. That workforce hasn't just stayed where they are. It's become an internationally recognised workforce.
Yes.
But it's ensured that their own needs have continued to be met and be met in really high quality people who want to stay there, live there, work there, have their careers there. The same principles will work in the country.
And does that mean building a bloody big hospital in the middle of South
Australia?
Absolutely
not.
No.
Absolutely it doesn't, because that's not the sort of health service we need. What we have shown over the last two decades, really, is that you don't need a big hospital to be able to get high-quality training. In fact, some of the highest quality training that's going on in Australia now in terms of medical training is happening in small hospitals, in community and private practice. The evidence that big is better in education is just not there. In fact, it's the opposite. The opportunity to have much closer relationships with your supervisors, to be more hands-on with your patients and to understand what it means to be a rural doctor in small locations is far more conducive to high-grade learning than being relatively anonymous in a large tertiary hospital. In fact, many students are voting with their feet and choosing to to learn in rural communities purely for the academic benefits. The problem is that they then have every intention to return to the city mm-hmm. with those academic qualifications, because that's where their family is, and
yes.
that's where
yes.
their life goals and aspirations are. I understand that.
Yeah.
And it can change if we reboot the medical training system to allow for there to be an equitable number of students and teachers who are based rurally for the length of their training, rather than just rotations out to rural.
There's been a lot of feeling that being a general practitioner just isn't a very healthy way to bring up a family, or is not family friendly for an aspiring doctor, say. How would the pathway help with that?
So what I've heard from young doctors is that increasingly general practice training has been less family friendly than it was previously.
Right.
The requirements for movement mm-hmm. Between different practices, the requirements for different employers
yes.
over the period of their training, and therefore the loss of maternity leave, long service leave, mm-hmm. training leaves, etc. All of those have resulted in general practice training becoming more disruptive to people who are also creating families than it was in the past, and than it is now in many other specialty training programs, where you have a single employer and you have, if not one hospital that you train in, it's basically one city
yes.
that you can be based in, and therefore you can take out a mortgage and you can live in one place and your kids can plan to go to school while you're training. That's become increasingly problematic in the general practice training
yeah.
and is one of the big issues that the Rural Generalist Pathway seeks to overcome by having regionally based training for the entire length of the pathway. Not that you are constrained there. There's always the opportunity, if you wish to go to Northern Ontario or to go to San Francisco or to go to Delhi or to go to Darwin to undertake some additional training. But it gives you the opportunity, if you need to and if you wish, to be able to have your family based in one place, your friends based in one place, and build a life at the same time as you're building your career.
Where do international medical graduates fit into the pathway?
So when I think of international contributions to rural medical workforce, I think in two ways. I think firstly in terms of those doctors who have committed to come to Australia after they've graduated and to serve our rural communities. And the place that they now have the opportunity to hold in our system is to be the supervisors of our next generation of doctors. We need those
cool.
international medical graduates, many of whom have become very experienced and much loved by
yes.
their communities.
Yes.
To now be able to train their successors and not rely on further visa-controlled doctors mm-hmm. to make up their practices. The other group of international contributors to the medical workforce in rural Australia are the students who come to study medicine here in Australia as international fee-paying students. And there should be every opportunity for those students to be able to undertake the rural generalist pathway.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, both groups of both students and doctors potentially yes. can benefit from the pathway.
Right.
Students by being able to join the pathway as interns or as junior doctors
yep.
and gain a fellowship here in Australia. And many of the international graduates who've come to Australia have graduated potentially with or have achieved potentially general practice fellowship qualifications here, but haven't attained those additional skills that many rural communities need from their rural generalists. What I'm talking about, those additional skills, I'm talking about skills in mental health, in obstetrics, in anaesthetics, in palliative care at specialist levels, so that they can treat the patients that in the city they would delegate to another specialist through a referral pathway. Mm. But in the country, you can't do that. So there will be options for both recognition of prior learning for domestic and international doctors mm-hmm. who are practicing in rural Australia. And there'll be opportunities, if they wish, for them to undertake further training to become qualified rural generalists as part of the pathway. This is often what I've seen around the country, is that international graduates have to find cultural friendship, cultural services, cultural opportunities with other groups of migrants who are often based in cities. The more we can provide those things in our regions, the more people will stay and the more they will have the fulfilling life that they deserve, just as much as we all do.
You talked about disunity, the difference between the unity levels within specialist colleges, for example, and disunity within general practice. Has that improved? I mean, my feeling is that the pathway itself has provided an opportunity for the two colleges to really solidify over this particular way forward.
The National Rural Generalist Pathway, I agree, has been a real focal point for the two general practice colleges to come together and to achieve something for rural Australia that neither could do on their own. That has meant that they have needed to look at how their educational frameworks can work together. And it's also meant that they've needed to look, along with the AMA and the Rural Doctors Association of Australia, at how the industrial frameworks need to come together and work together. And the principle that we have been able to agree on and to work with is that you should get paid for what you do. Therefore, if you are providing a general practice service, providing a level 23 consultation, item 23 consultation, whether you are a rural generalist qualified or a general practice qualified doctor, you should get paid the same. If you are delivering a baby and you can use the item number for an uncomplicated confinement and delivery, you should get paid the same whether you are a rural generalist or a specialist obstetrician. And that already exists. Those parities already exist. Likewise, in the surgical areas, if you take a lesion off a person's skin, whether you are a plastic surgeon or a rural generalist surgeon, you can use the same item number. Where that hasn't happened is in the consulting specialty areas. Right. So when you get rural generalists who undertake additional training and get additional skills in psychiatry, who get additional skills in palliative care, who get additional skills in emergency medicine care, who get additional skills in aged care, up to now they have not been able to access the same item numbers for the same work, for the same consultation as their specialist colleagues.
Mm.
That doesn't make logical sense in our current system. And the two GP colleges, the RDA and the RDA, have been able to agree that that principle now needs to apply in the consulting specialties as well as in the procedural item numbers. That takes further discussion and negotiation.
Yes.
The financial implications to government are not very significant because you're dealing with small numbers.
Yes.
But the implications to rural communities are profound. What that will mean is that you will then get a generation of rural generalists deciding to train in aged care, in palliative care, in mental health, in drug and addiction medicine, knowing but they are not choosing to be the sacrificial lambs in terms of their incomes compared to training to do rural generalist obstetrics practice or rural generalist anaesthetics practice. If you train in mental health and all you can do is use general practice item numbers, then that's not attractive. That's not going to attract the numbers of people we need in our rural communities to have those additional skills in mental health or in drug and alcohol. So if we're going to shift the trainees into the areas that rural communities need,
yes,
we need to reflect that in the access to Medicare item numbers and the other supports that they need in terms of the multidisciplinary teams that invariably are involved, so that they can practice those areas with confidence and they can get supported financially to do that.
I'm speaking today with Paul Worley, the National Rural Health Commissioner. His co-authored perspective can be found at mja.com.au. Don't forget you can subscribe to our podcast feed for free on iTunes. Back to our chat. Is it difficult to convince city doctors or city colleges or city bureaucracies that quality rural healthcare is worth thinking about because it benefits city healthcare?
If you had asked me that question 25 years ago, I may give a different answer to now. But I think one of the things that the rural clinical school work has done is that it has shown to predominantly city-based university leaders, and who often also are leaders in their professional colleges,
yes,
that it is very possible. In fact, it's the norm now to have really high quality education occurring in those rural regions. And what one of the reasons for that is that the supervisors are also high quality. So it becomes a virtual cycle that starts reinforcing itself to the extent that people, I doubt, now would ever be looking at saying we can get away with second-class medicine in rural areas. Not at all. People are saying you need to have the same outcomes. It's a social justice issue. It's an economic right, a social right, and it's achievable. If you look at, let's look at an example of what's happened in cardiac care in South Australia.
Yes.
25 years ago, you would have said, well, you chose to live in a rural town, therefore you can't expect to have the same outcome if you have a heart attack. That's no longer the case. You can have the same morbidity and mortality predictors if you are living in Millicent, in the southeast of South Australia, compared to if you're living in Menindee, just next to the city. And that's the way it should be.
Yeah,
it's, of course. It's a different approach to medicine. It's a different treatment pathway, but the outcomes are equivalent. That's what rural communities deserve. It's what we have the ability to deliver. And my sense now is that all the professional colleges are absolutely on board with the fact that it is their responsibility as well as responsibility of the health departments to do everything that's possible to ensure those outcomes are equivalent. Different ways of doing things, different approaches, but there's no such thing as second-class citizens anymore.
Does good healthcare in the country make for better healthcare in the city?
There's some fantastic evidence that I can point you towards being absolutely the case. Right. If you look at most city tertiary and quaternary hospitals, they will have at any one time between sometimes 15 to 30% of their inpatient beds from country citizens. You know, it depends on the jurisdiction. But if you look at improving the country health system so that there's less outflow and therefore less of those beds being used by country people, that helps the whole city system in terms of bed block, in terms of ambulance ramping, in terms of the costs of retrievals and transfers, all of those things. So the whole system actually benefits if you get the right care delivered in the right place by the right person at the right time. Our current system of transfers and sort of snatch and grab and transport,
retrievals, yeah,
etc., that was the best that we could offer a couple of decades ago, but no longer can we get away with that sort of treatment. And no longer do we have to. I've been to numerous regional centres now that are providing really high quality care. And therefore, I'm very confident that they can train the next generation to provide that really high quality care. When the new Royal Adelaide Hospital was built in Adelaide the last couple of years, they had to transfer the services from the old hospital to the new. What that required was basically downsizing the old Royal Adelaide Hospital to a shadow of its former self, mm-hmm. so that over a week or so, all the services could be moved to the new hospital. Where did a lot of those patients go? They went to rural hospitals. What we found was that there's actually a capacity, not only for the bush to look after its own more competently and for longer, but also there's the opportunity for city patients to undertake rehabilitation, elective procedures, other care in rural hospitals, where they'll often get the things done more quickly. And if they have relatives in those towns, then it's actually not much of a social detriment either. It's what country citizens have been doing for a long time, coming yes. to the city
yep.
and having to stay with relatives while they had care. There's actually the opportunity to do that the other way around. And if you look at in our system, where is the spare capacity, if there is any, and there isn't a lot,
mm-hmm.
but if there is any spare bed capacity, it's actually in our rural hospitals. So if we were to make better use of the beds that we already have in our rural hospitals, then the whole system will benefit.
If you had a magic wand, Paul, and you could change something right now, what would it be?
My sense is that the two ministers responsible for rural health, mm-hmm. Minister McKenzie last year and Minister Coulton this year, have made that decision, because what they've said is if we've got the opportunity to do something for rural health, what will we do? Firstly, we will create a sustainable cadre of rural generalist medical practitioners who will provide the services that rural communities need, who will build up the economic capacity of the regions,
mm-hmm.
In more ways than just the health service. We all know that, you know, health services are the heart and often the economic driver of a whole lot of other industry in rural areas. And they'll give hope and opportunity to rural families,
mm-hmm.
that their kids can have careers where they live.
Yeah.
Not that they have to. Many kids want to move elsewhere.
Yep. Yep.
But if they do want to stay around home, staying on the farm isn't the only choice. They can take these other careers. So the magic wand, exactly what I've been asked to do. The National Rural Generalist Pathway last year,
yep.
and this year, looking at how we can use the same principles and the same opportunities to create that other really important part of the rural workforce, which is the allied health workforce. How can we provide a sustainable, high-quality, well-distributed allied health workforce that can benefit not just the health sector,
mm-hmm.
but aged care, disability, schools, justice,
mm-hmm.
All of those other sectors that allied health professionals have a role to play in.
How important are the Indigenous health workers in that allied health push?
At the moment, if you ask the Aboriginal health workers and Aboriginal health practitioners, mm-hmm. they all say that they don't regard themselves as allied health professionals. They are on an equal footing, allied health professionals, but they are a separate profession,
a separate
group of health workers. In everything that I've done as the National Rural Health Commissioner, I have tried to learn from Aboriginal people as much as possible, from their holistic understanding of health, which very much relates to a generalist approach to healthcare, and from the way they articulate their spiritual connection with the land that they live in and live on and live with, that I think articulates something that we all feel. That's a connection to place. That connection to place underpins why we've got the problem that we currently have and points towards the solution for the future, which is homegrown workforce, is a health service that takes responsibility for greater proportion of care for its population because it can produce the workforce that it needs in order to be able to provide that. So Aboriginal health workers and Aboriginal health practitioners, absolutely vital part of the health workforce. But don't stop there. Think of what the Aboriginal worldview can offer to Australia to create a truly Australian health service for urban and rural communities, one that is based on an attachment to place, one that is collaborative, culturally safe, inclusive, and one that understands we are not just a system of cells and we're not just a system of zeros and ones on some population database.
Mm-hmm.
We are holistic beings who have a biopsychosocio-spiritual existence and deserve that approach to our care.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been fascinating.
Pleasure, Kate.
Thanks, Paul. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.